So our speaker this morning, or this afternoon, is Scott Krenz. He's actually joined us on stage a couple of times before. Been very fortunate to have him. I really like that he's sort of a kind of truth teller, very honest, very straightforward speaker. Really delighted to have him here today. And today Scott's going to talk about real-time enterprise in terms of some of the challenges and some of the opportunities. So please give a warm welcome to Juniper CEO and Chairman Scott Krenz.
Thank you. Hi, Lenny. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for filling up the room and giving me some time today. A couple things to start with. One, if you have any messages that you'd like to send for those that have BlackBerries or other things, we're going to be jamming the signal in about 5 minutes. So send those out. Wouldn't that be a great piece of technology? You could just put it in the center of your next meeting. The thing that I want to talk about today, and I always like to do this at shows in particular because this is where you can sort of see all things. You can see that which is real and that which is promised and that also which in many cases will never happen. And you know, to the comment Lenny made about how this evolves and what we're trying to do, you know, we are trying to create a world where everything talks to everything, which is kind of like saying, can't we just all get along? Wouldn't it be great if we had world peace? But the problem, and why the search for what's real is so important, is it's not that simple. And so what I want to try and use the time today to do, and I'll use this in going through the agenda here, is to talk about the goal, because it's an admirable goal, and we'll talk a little bit about why that is, and then we'll talk about the reality and the difference between what we want and what we have, and then at least some thoughts about how we might bridge that gap and a plan where I'll be a bit more specific about at least what we see and what we're trying to do at Juniper. One of the things I will not do, although there's a great deal of Juniper technology involved in all of this that is obviously very real, it's, I guess literally, more than proverbial, it's literally behind the curtain. It's over there. We have a booth. We have a lot of folks there with a great deal of expertise on the Juniper product line. I've never really felt that keynotes are about commercial advertisements for your products, so I won't be doing that today, but I'll certainly invite you in advance to go and visit with the many Juniper folks that will be there to talk about how we make this real. But let's take a look, if you will, at the evolution, and I won't spend a lot of time here, but just to kind of set a stage. Yesterday we had the client-server environment, and that obviously had its day. We've gone to the web-based world where it's now clientless, and we're looking to get to this world that Lenny mentioned, where people and devices and machines and information all talk to each other in this seamless fashion. And it is a beautiful thing. But it's hard to do. There is a reason for doing it, and there is something we're trying to accomplish with this whole vision that we have as an industry. And it's about trying to tackle an old problem or a challenge that's existed for a long time, which is the challenge of the triangle. And the fact that you can have, on, as you see on the screen there, good, fast, and cheap, pick any two. But there's no magic. You can't, we don't know, let me just put it that way, I don't know how to have good, fast, and cheap all at the same time. If we think of the downturn we went through some years ago in this industry, I would say most of us struggled with the condition where we wanted it to be good because quality was important. Money was very hard to come by, and so things slowed way down out of necessity. And there's also an environment we can imagine in boom times where there's so much going on that even if it costs a lot, getting it right and doing it fast is really important. But I don't really know how to do all three of those all at once. And so, in trying to optimize this reality, rather than pretend that we can do that, we have to look at a question of risk. And risk has a lot of dimensions. We all face it in our own environments and in our own markets, and it means different things in different times. But just to pick a couple of elements that it's driven by, what is my competition doing? What is my opportunity? And what's the growth potential out there if and as I execute? And depending on my answers to those questions, I might choose any two of those three choices in that triangle and say I'm willing to compromise on the third for the benefit of the other two to optimize this risk I'm trying to manage. Here's where I think we can make a difference in how we use the technologies that are out there on the other side of that curtain to change things a little bit, which isn't to pretend that the constraint goes away, but to give us the ability to optimize this by responding and changing fast. Because while I can't change the, I'll call it a fact of nature, that I can only have two of the three, what I can do, given that times change, is I can create a very responsive environment under which I can change the two I picked to two different ones based on the changing risk. And so this, at least by one perspective, is, in my opinion, one of the things we're trying to accomplish at the highest level. Now, how do I do that? And I'll use an overused word here, go virtual. Share assets. I give a couple of examples here around outsourced manufacturing, the fabless semiconductor, the contract workforce. All of these things are well known and underway. And if we ask ourselves, first of all, how they exist and then why they exist. They exist and they perpetuate because one of the things we're able to accomplish with the networks that we build is an environment where we can do two things at once, which is share assets that we don't own. Because I ultimately, in running a business, I believe one of the goals is to own as little of the assets as possible and do only those things and own only those things that I need to deliver the differentiation that creates the value. And so I'd really like to share as much as possible. The problem is we can't afford to give away control of those things we'd like to share. So on the one dimension, control is very important, but if in exchange for having the control, I lose the ability to share it, then it costs too much. And if you think of it the other way around, if instead I say, you know, I'm really willing to share it with anyone because I don't want the cost, if that means I don't have control over my production capacity or the timeliness of response to a customer, that's a big problem. And so part of what we're trying to do here in optimizing this triangle is be able to move into the always desirable upper right-hand quadrant, where we can have control over assets without having to own them. And when we talk about at least some of the things I think are going to be displayed on the floor and some of what I'll try and describe here in this goal, what we're trying to figure out how to do is how to make that happen for the business owner. Because that creates an opportunity to optimize something that turns out to be very important in how well my business runs. Now, an interesting point about this, at least when we talk about what we do at Juniper and why, it's not per se. We don't outsource. We have operations in India. We have operations in China. We do development in both countries. We do development in Israel. The primary motivation is not cost of labor. The primary motivation is being able to virtualize the assets because what I can do with those now virtual assets is I can turn them up and turn them down because I'm not stuck with the fixed cost of owning them. And what I mean to show with the slide here is that if you look at that line of cost going through there, if I can move that line up and down with my revenue opportunities shown on the one axis, that means I can maximize the profit, I can spend more when there's opportunity, and I can shut off the spending when the growth or when the market cycles change. And so I minimize the red and I maximize the green. When the history's written about offshoring, what it will say in the economics books is that that benefit became the strategic motivation for the offshoring decision, or the strategic motivation for the outsourcing and virtualizing of a workforce or of a contract capability. It was because I could turn it up and I could turn it down, and it allowed me to create more green and less red. So this is, if you will, a foundation behind one of the things we're trying to accomplish. If we think of it, forgetting about all the technology, we're just out here trying to do something that would make a difference to all of us in operating our businesses. Before we get to how we're going to do it, this, I think, is what we're trying to do. Now, if we peel the onion a little bit, this to me was a very interesting piece of information that came from CME Corporation. And I hope it's an easy enough thing to explain here, but if you look at the graph there and go up and down the axis to 100%, that's basically IT spend normalized. I mean, how much do we spend on IT at a point in time? And if you look at the cycles that are identified there, the dawn of the technology in the first place, and I didn't really try to delineate or claim that I can declare cause and effect in black and white terms for these things, but there were evolutions here, certainly the PC, Win95, the internet. These are the examples that CME used when they did this work. And what you see is that during phases of new technology and its adoption, IT spend goes above normal, and in between those phases, it dips down. Now, here's the interesting point to me on the graph. If you look over after Win95, there's a significant drop, unsurprisingly, around the decline that went with the burst of the bubble and all of that in IT spend to, if you go all the way back to the 40s, almost unbelievably low levels. And if you draw the trend line through this, it's up and to the right. And so the question is, what if we assume, and you can see it started to head back, I think this goes to the end of about 05. But the question is, what's the next big thing? Because if we really look at those levels, and if that's relevant information, and I think it is, and we've spent some time trying to understand this, you know, with folks that put it together at CME, there's a big gap there. And so something is going to happen. And I believe it's going to happen to try and address that business cycle and to try and do some of the things that we're all out to accomplish in the business. But there's some real quantitative evidence behind the fact that there's a big thing looming. Now, what's that going to be? So let me offer a theory. I think it's SOA. The problem with SOA is it's kind of like Web 2.0. At some point, the label doesn't mean anything because it means everything. So let's try and look a little bit more carefully at what that means, or at least what's evolving. And this I'll put in the context of the network element here, and I'll come back to how that relates, since that's the world that at least we live in at Juniper. We all know about the evolution of the LAN. As there became more of those, then the WAN became at least one of the next big things, if you will, big with a small b. The internet we know about, the evolution of the IP infrastructure, which we actually believe is sort of the superset or the next gen of the internet. And what we really see now is we want more than just an IP infrastructure or an internet. We've got applications out there, and what we'd really like to do is tie those all together. And when we tie all that together, we get the online real-time enterprise. And the online real-time enterprise is part of what makes this sort of seamless reality between machines and people and devices and information happen. Because really, at least in the enterprise environment, and I'm setting aside the consumer discussion around movies and music and digital entertainment for a different day, but in the business world that we're trying to support with the technologies, it's about trying to take the applications and marry them in this SOA environment and create this notion of the real-time enterprise. And if we peel the onion a little bit on real-time enterprise and ask ourselves, okay, what is that? These are at least three elements that we can try and separate: the infrastructure itself, the applications that we're trying to drive across the infrastructure, and ultimately in service of the business agenda and processes or practices within that business that are important to the objectives that we have. And if we look at those objectives, the business objectives themselves, in the context of what, for those that may be CIOs in the audience or those of us who serve the CIOs with our technologies, what makes a CIO successful? Well, it's what the CEO wants. And at least for one, probably oversimplification, the CEO doesn't want technology. The business objective is not about technology, it's about creating opportunities that solve problems. And the question then is, how does one do that? And one of the things which is interesting, there's a couple of other data points, I didn't reference them up here, but in one case, Accenture went out and surveyed 300 CIOs and said, what's the most important thing on your agenda to do as you look out over your, I think it was a 2 or 3 year planning horizon? And the answer was aggressive technology adoption. How can I adopt technology faster? And this was in support of a, these weren't related, it just happened to be interesting, couple of pieces of data. The Economist went out and surveyed 4,000 business leaders in 23 different countries and asked a completely non-technology question altogether. What is most important to you in your business? And what's the thing which you feel defines your competitive advantage over your planning horizon? And the answer was, we have to accelerate execution of our strategy, whatever that is, however we can do it. And it isn't, obviously the comment had nothing to do with technology. But when that translates and the CEO says, I need you to create opportunities for this business with the IT investment or solve problems in this business with the IT investment, I would submit, with at least these two pieces of data, that it's about adopting technology aggressively to accelerate the execution of the particular strategy of the business in order to develop and deliver a competitive advantage. And over 60% of those companies and those business leaders said that IT was a competitive advantage and not a cost center. So, if we, you know, in trying to kind of narrow this down from the dream state, what does that then mean that the CIO does in response to that? And this is really where trying to drive application development, trying to drive SOA becomes important, and I'll put up a couple more pieces of data here. By 2008, 80% of the new development projects will provide it will be provided as through the basis of SOA, which is a Gartner piece of data. By 2010, 80% of the application software revenue growth comes from SOA. Yankee, I didn't put this number up there, but Yankee had a number attached to this also. In 2010, the SOA-related spending will be $11 billion. So that's a big thing. The other one is software as a service. And again, I'll borrow some Gartner and Forrester numbers here. 1/3 of all new software delivered as a service by 2010. 25% of large enterprises already have adopted software as a service. Now, in most cases, that's a departmental adoption. That's not a strategic corporate adoption. So there's lots to do here. And the purpose of this talk isn't really to go into the detail of SOA and how it works, but simply to observe that there's something very real happening. And so, it's not an if condition, it's a when condition. Because we've got new technologies, and again, that's not the purpose of this talk, but if we look behind SOA and say, well, what's really going on in the world of XML, in the evolution of XML, WSDL, SOAP technologies to provide protocols for interoperability, there's a bunch of stuff going on that's very real. So it isn't to say that this is at all a pipe dream. And there's an increasing demand for the flexibility and the agility that SOA brings and the accelerated execution of the business strategies and all that. So it's a very real thing. But here's another piece of data that's kind of interesting. And again, I'll borrow Simi's numbers here. Only 20% of companies have got an adequate SOA infrastructure to take the idea and turn it into a reality. So while it's a good idea, it's really quite problematic to imagine how the infrastructure that makes all of this possible is going to happen. Now, if we take a look at sort of what's behind that infrastructure problem, and we put it in the context of a reality check here for the CIO. New technology, clearly a challenge. Organizational change, though, because if it's an online real-time application that we're after, who does the online part, who does the real-time part, and who does the application part? And today, if we look across the organization, I put three examples of what I would submit in many conditions are silos up there. And they all have a perspective. The application's perspective, if you ask them to diagram their view of the universe, would show you a world like this with lots of servers and storage and interconnected equipment for the purposes of developing and maintaining the applications and the database. And in their drawing of the world, you'd have a little cloud in the corner, and that would be for the network people to solve. Not a complicated problem, anybody could do it. The real issue is applications. And if you turned and asked the question from the infrastructure, the network provider's point of view, find this on Juniper diagrams all over the place. Lots of pictures of routers, security devices, switches, all that stuff. And we just stick a terminal off the side of it and say, you know, that's the application part, it's no big deal. And then if you went even further and asked the security guy, he'd say, I actually don't care about either one of those things. They can happen at whatever pace those guys can execute against. What's really important is securing the network, and that's the gate you have to get through. And then I didn't put this slide up again, but I was thinking about this from a conversation I actually had with someone this morning. There's a fourth dimension that could have been put up here, which is the compliance officer's point of view, which is in order to get to Sarbanes-Oxley compliance, or other examples of the same requirements outside of North America and the US, I don't actually care about either of any of those three other things. If it's not compliant, it doesn't go out. And if it's today working in production and it's not compliant, all new development stops while you go back and fix that. So there's some significant barriers to this happening that have nothing to do with the technology, but are very much the problem or the challenge that the CIO faces in trying to make this work, because these worlds exist in relative independence. And there's obviously changes happening that make this important, because ultimately the winning point of view in all of this comes from taking these technologies and the cultures in these environments and tying them together. So this is something that's actually very important before we worry about how to make an XML-based real-time application available across multiple databases throughout or across enterprises. Now, if we then look to, we'll go back to this real-time enterprise and ask ourselves, there's some requirements here. Let's look very specifically at infrastructure. And obviously, you know, I'll sort of qualify this in advance. That's the world that we live in at Juniper. So we're the ones that put the little terminal in the corner and believe this is probably the center of the universe, or at least should believe that. I actually think the application's more important. But here's some data that's kind of interesting. If you talk to, in this case, these are Gartner numbers again, over 1,000 CIOs ask this question, managing flexible and efficient infrastructures are top priorities. Here's another piece. IT reacts very slowly to the requirements with unpredictable reliability and expenses, which aren't really correlated to the business problem. Now, why is that true? Well, it's true because 70% of the IT spend is on infrastructure. Now, that's more than just network infrastructure. That's, I guess, capital I infrastructure. But it's not on application development. And if the objective is to create opportunities and solve problems and accelerate deployment, that's done in service of business process and practices by deploying applications. And yet the problem we have is that 70% of the budget that should be used for doing that is being spent on the infrastructure itself. So the reason for the numbers and for sort of pulling together the point is that the problem we face in reaching this real-time condition, even though we're the ones that sell the hammers and think everything is a nail, so with that qualifier, It's also true that there's some data that would suggest that the problem has to start with infrastructure, or at least have quite a fair bit to do with it, because of its disproportionate consumption of the budget. So, what does that mean has to happen? Let's pull the infrastructure out of here, at least in the Juniper world, or let's call it the network world, and take a look at infrastructure and ask ourselves what that means. And here I'll move to a bit more of at least the plan as we see it, or the approach. The evolution of the infrastructure is one of managing a series of demands on that infrastructure. And I'll put a couple of axes up here. There could be more. But one of them is agility. What's the speed of response? How quickly can that infrastructure adopt to change and adapt to new requirements that weren't there yesterday and are mission critical today or tomorrow? And then also, on a different axis, what's the intelligence of that infrastructure and its ability to respond aside from the speed at which it can do it? So I may be able to change it quickly, but is it smart enough to do the thing that I need it to do after I change it? Now, there are a couple of other axes I could have put up there around reliability. I mean, is it reliable while doing those things? Is it safe? Is it of necessary capacity or necessary performance? All issues, but in the simplest case, we're trying to balance the speed and the substance in this objective of being more responsive. And what we believe that translates to mean as a requirement is that there is the need to deliver a proven IP infrastructure for, if you will, enabling this real-time enterprise. And so how do we approach trying to do that here at Juniper with the part of the contribution that we take responsibility for? And there's lots of ways to answer this and a lot more detail behind it that's available out on the show floor, but here's the strategy behind it, if you will, which is twofold. First of all, it has to be customer oriented. That means a lot of different things. It's got to be simple. It's not fast, it's not reliable, and it's not cost effective if it's not simple. Because complexity is the enemy of all things in this world that we live in, at least. So making it simple is really important. Making it standards based. Lenny mentioned the commitment we have to that. Open network, standards-based capabilities. If we go back to thinking about those silos that the CIO manages between the different worlds that relegate the others that are actually necessary for success to being a trivial piece of the problem in the corner of the slide, one of the ways that has to be addressed is that you've got to deliver an open technology to allow it to be utilized by others. It's not about land grabs trying to make it so that one wins and dominates the other and dictates the terms. Open standards, open technology is critical. One of the reasons it's critical is because we need to be able to leverage the investments that have already been made. It can't be such that what we do with proprietary technologies is force upgrades and overhauls of the network because it's not compatible. And then finally, there's an organizational behavior, and by this I mean the Juniper organization and the requirement for us as a company to respond to the needs for this being a comprehensive solution, and I'll actually come back to that. And then on the other dimension here is the notion of it being a no-compromises solution, and this is, if you will, what you might call the and problem. And the and problem is it's got to be high performance, it's got to scale, it's got to be reliable, it has to be secure, it's got to be very intelligent, and. It's not acceptable to compromise one of those elements of the proposition. Because a highly responsive, reliable, stupid network has no value. And a really smart, insecure, non-secured network has no value. So this and problem of delivering across multiple axes simultaneously without compromise is one of the fundamental attributes behind this notion of proven IP infrastructure for the real-time enterprise. And we think of it as proven in the context of being proven in the largest networks in the world. Networks with 7 or 8 million Koreans or Germans, in the cases where we've done this in the service provider marketplace and now bring this to the enterprise, we believe we can bring a scale and some evidence behind it that is pretty compelling. That's one part of the approach. There's a second part of it. And the second part of it has to do with how we deal with the fact that we can't do everything. And it's about embracing collaboration, best-in-class expertise, do what we do really well and make that really important. And then complement it with win-win partnerships and open standards, as I mentioned before. And there was an example of that in recent news, built around a principle that we think of as natural boundaries. There are natural boundaries to be respected in the evolution of technology markets, where even though it would be, if you think of it from a sort of an individual company's point of view, it would be nice if I could own those surrounding spaces. Just like it would be nice if I could walk and swim and fly. But it doesn't turn out to be possible that ducks do that. Ducks don't do any of that very well. So where are the boundaries behind what we should do and where we should partner? And these boundaries and having respect for them just as we would in nature is actually really important, because it doesn't matter what I want. It matters what makes most sense as a solutions proposition for a buyer and for a marketplace, because ultimately the market's very powerful. It dictates the answers to these questions, not the other way around. And so here's one example in recent news, which is Juniper and Symantec, who entered into a relationship last week. And it's built around trying to do a couple of things. Take the core competence in network infrastructure that we have and the capabilities we bring and marry it to endpoint and information security delivered by Symantec across 100 million desktops with capabilities around antivirus, anti-spam, URL filtering, a lot of other things that go into a very comprehensive portfolio. And perhaps you'll hear more about this in a talk later when Mark comes up, I think tomorrow. What do we do when we do that if we do it well? Best-in-class capabilities around security intelligence, which allows us to develop faster response to threats, and then comprehensive coverage of that threat across the infrastructure and the endpoints. Simpler solutions, lower cost as a result, freedom of choice because it's all built on open standards, and then the investment leverage of the reality that there are 100 million desktops out there already in place, and there already is Juniper infrastructure across the largest networks in the world. And the marriage of those two and the partnership that we've talked about allows us to deliver something which on the surface is very simple. And the beauty of it is it doesn't get a whole lot more complicated as we implement and execute this. Taking the capabilities on the desktop or in the data center, marrying that with intelligence and technology and the network infrastructure and making it possible for a comprehensive proposition to be deployed, which we think is to the benefit of everyone. So one example. Let me change direction a little bit here and talk about what this translates to as it relates to a challenge that we think buyers have in this market. And there's a third dimension that I would suggest needs to be inserted in how we think about the problem. In the simplest case, and these are a couple of different examples of choices, this is more, I think this is Gartner information again. There are several choices a buyer has in how to make these decisions or move into these environments. And here lies the challenge. One is the sort of simple case of just going out and finding the point product solution. There's another choice in the middle, which is looking for a strategic vendor for major initiatives. And then there's a choice at the top end of saying, I just do anything my vendor suggests. May not say that out front. May wish I didn't do that. May not even want to do it. But ultimately, that's what I do. Now, which of those cases makes the most sense? And I think in the industry, we find ourselves in this condition where we tend to only define the two ends of the spectrum, either the point product solution or the end-to-end solution, if you will. But it turns out, and there was some research that Gartner did behind this that was really quite compelling, which is that the sweet spot's actually in the middle, and picking strategic vendors for major initiatives saves 25%, improves responsiveness, and increases performance. And it keeps everybody on their toes. So while sometimes we try and oversimplify this and look at one extreme or the other, like many things, there's an answer in the middle which is important. And that's why these partnerships are so important, because it allows us to complementary approach to building strategic solutions or solutions from strategic suppliers that is more powerful than living at one end or the other of this sort of simple proposition. Now, there's a responsibility in this, in my opinion, also, for all of us as sellers or vendors, if you will, and that's to avoid something. And this is, with no disrespect to any example, this is what we face in the industry that actually is one of the more frustrating conditions, which is vendor promises about how this is going to be the most unprecedented, revolutionary, world-class, next-gen, integrated, all dancing, singing, end of your problems, answer to all things. And it's an easy thing to put in a bunch of PowerPoint slides, and man, it feels good to say it. And it actually has some unintended consequences, which it is it causes buyers to write RFPs asking for the impossible, asking for the triangle, if you will. Give me the lowest cost, uncompromising quality, reliability, speed, time to market, flexible performance, answer to all things. And what you end up with in trying to do that is an incredibly frustrated condition, and as a result, ultimately broken trust, which comes from it's kind of like in the political world, people, or at least some people, if you're a political skeptic, you might believe that politicians will say anything to get elected. And then once you get elected, we'll kind of introduce reality. But up front, I'm going to lower taxes, I'm going to increase spending, and we're going to reduce the deficit. What could be wrong with that? Except that it doesn't really happen that way, and so we end up with a broken trust. And the responsibility I think we have as sellers in all of this is to repair the trust, better yet, not to behave that way in the first place. And that's what goes back to this notion of working around best in class, taking responsibility for a problem and for bringing a strategic solution, and then with open standards and these win-win partnerships, figuring out how to make that the best answer in that sweet spot for the buyers who face the challenge of trying to solve for the optimal condition when there's no way to outsmart the triangle. So, just a couple final thoughts, and I'll let everyone go to the floor here and hopefully stop by the Juniper booth as well. What do we believe in all this? There are some fundamental things we believe inside the company. One of them is that it's important to look and listen and learn. One of the things I learned a long time ago, told to me by someone I respect as much as anyone in the world, you can't learn anything while you're talking. Because hopefully, at least, you already know whatever's coming out of your mouth. So the only way to learn is to listen. And so one of the tenets that is central to us is to start by listening. And after we listen and try to understand, then we ask questions. And once we have done our best, then we'll try and come up with some answers. The way that those responsibilities get compromised in the seller's role in all of this is when you invert that condition and start with the answers and then go out and retrofit all the questions in the situation into them. We don't think that works. And if instead, and this is really what we commit to do as a company, and it's probably, I'd also put it in the category of call to action for those of us within the industry on all sides of it. Let's do away with the PowerPoint promises. And instead, let's try and develop some real understanding about what we're talking about. And with that comes an acknowledgement of the real limitations and the real opportunities. And then from that, we'll be able to develop some real answers. And with these real answers, let's do some real collaboration. Not idle, empty words, not empty declarations, but real collaboration, real commitment to open standards, real partnerships of real substance. Because if we do that, what we end up with is real solutions. And if we have real solutions, then we make real progress. And so, in the spirit of that being what we believe is important, and being a part of what we try and represent each day and what forms the fabric or the DNA of Juniper. If you would be so kind as to stop by and visit with us, what you'll find is real people who have real products. There are real answers to these questions. I don't mean to be a doomsayer or talk about this as if it wasn't possible, because people are going to spend, as we mentioned, $11 billion on this in the next 3 or 4 years. And if we really did have a world where application development was accelerated and response times were improved, response time for businesses, that would make a big difference. And the difference is available for us to make by taking, in our opinion, the kind of steps that we've talked about and making that something that as an industry we commit to. And we do it one company, one project, one RFP, one product at a time. So I don't paint this picture as something we can do overnight, but if each of us took one step towards doing real work on this, we'd make real progress. So with that, thank you very much for taking the time to spend with me. I think Lenny's going to step back up with a couple of closing comments, but I really appreciate your attention today. You may turn back on your BlackBerries. And please enjoy the show, and thanks for making the time. Thanks very much.